From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. What follows will be an ominous look at an extremely familiar media institution. But first, buzzword time.
We have lots of talk about disruption this morning. Companies taking old-fashioned industries and shaking them up.
The digital era has disrupted the business of journalism, as many of you know.
One of the hottest startups disrupting the industry.
What I call digital disruption.
Nowadays, it means positive, radical change, which is swell if you're not the one being disrupted. For instance, what if you'd cornered the children's shoelaces market when Velcro came along? Or what if you were a symphony orchestra living off the subscriptions of rapidly aging and steadily expiring music lovers? What if you were a car maker and consumers wished to shop directly from the factory? You couldn't allow it because that would cut your current customers, the dealers you depend on, out of the deal. Or worse, what if the biggest dealers started selling brands of their own? Any of these scenarios could be ruinous. Put them all together and you have the existential threat variety pack. Technological, competitive, demographic, and internecine. And every last one of them applies to
You're listening to NPR.
Yes, the nation's largest producer and distributor of public media is being buffeted from all sides because the space it once monopolized is now packed with an ever-growing number of competitors that you probably think of as NPR, but which are not. Among them, PRI, American Public Media, PRX, and our host station, WNYC, which is an NPR member station, in fact, its biggest customer, but also a direct competitor pitching its own national programs, like this one, to other stations. Then there are the commercial podcasting companies like Gimlet, Slate Panoply, Midroll, and Audible, all creating rich, compelling, highly narrative content.
What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast.
I'm Slate, it's the gist.
This is Lexicon Valley.
Welcome to another round with Heaven and Tracy.
From Gimlet, this is Reply All.
Battling for the same sets of eardrums. As NYU journalism professor and new media thinker Clay Shirky observes, it's quite a tangle. I strongly advise you to grab a pencil and take notes. A flowchart would be good.
The obvious conflict is between the member stations, the KBIAs and WNYCs of the country. Those stations buy shows from NPR, collect money for those shows, pay the money back to NPR. NPR uses the money to produce the shows. And so there's a whole ecosystem there, which assumes that the only way NPR shows get into your ears is via these member stations. There is a problem with being in the middle there.
With him so far?
Then there's the conflict between the small member stations that don't produce their own shows and places like WNYC, which has some interest in having its audio products get out in the podcasting world as well as on terrestrial radio. So there's tension between the member stations as well. And then, of course, there's a whole host of other producers of radio and podcasts for whom the move to podcasting allows them to do something that would have been inconceivable 5 years ago, which is to compete with NPR on level turf. And that collection of bundled up, complicated relationships, it can never be untangled. It's the Gordian knot. Someone's just going to have to come along and cut it. And cutting this particular Gordian knot looks like saying, the podcasting thing is going to happen anyway. NPR might as well move into the future it knows is going to happen.
Right. The future is on demand. The audience awaits. All NPR has to do is serve it directly with its own podcasts and its own app called NPR One, an algorithmically curated on-demand streaming service. Except, like the previously mentioned automaker, NPR doesn't get its funds directly from consumers. It gets its money from its dealers, the roughly 950 member stations. And every listener to whom NPR serves a podcast is a listener who is not listening to those stations. This otherwise arcane conundrum leapt into public view last month when an NPR executive issued a memo forbidding the active hyping of podcasts and the NPR app on NPR's airwaves. The internet lit up in mockery, and Professor Shirky artfully plotted with Confederates to buy underwriting time on NPR shows to pitch NPR's own podcasts and its app to its own listeners.
I don't know if I will hear back from them, but I said very clearly, we would like to buy a sponsorship for Weekend Edition, and we would like to use it to promote NPR One.
At the beginning, it was so simple.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Robert Conley with All Things Considered.
Back in 1971, All Things Considered went on the air with a clear mission.
Genuine diversity of regions, values, and cultural and ethnic minorities, which comprise American society.
This is NPR's founding program director, Bill Siemering, reading that mission statement.
National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
That ideal was tested on NPR's very first day on the air, covering an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C.
This green and growing land, walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand.
Then I was running through a parking lot, someone threw a club at me.
Threw a club at you?
Yeah, threw a club at me.
Sergeant, excuse me, Jeff Kamen, National Public Radio. Is that a technique where the men actually try to drive the bikes into the demonstrators?
No, it's no technique. We're trying to go down the road and the people get in front. What are you going to do? You don't stop on a dime.
45 years later, NPR is more sophisticated, more professional, more entertaining, more far-flung, and it offers vastly more things considered. But as it's evolved, has it also strayed? Siemering is in awe of the institution that's emerged from his original vision, but...
Initially, I envisioned that about a third of the program would come from stations, so we would have the country hearing itself, and that's never happened. I think the pressure of the news these days kind of crowded out that idea of let's hear America talking to itself.
The job is not to raise money or to make sure that people buy a product. The job is to educate and inform and make sure you're serving your communities.
Melody Joy Kramer is a digital strategist and former NPR journalist.
And if the people who are working in it aren't serving it, then we need to go back to the research table and say, like, how can we do better and how can we meet the needs of somebody who, you know, arrived in the United States not too long ago and is using public media to learn English, or somebody who is getting news snippets because they work a night shift. These are public media listeners too, and their voices might not be heard in the current discussions.
You know, our mission is to do things for the American public that the commercial media doesn't always do.
Scott Finn is the head of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
And we can lose our way if we think that our main job is to produce really, you know, super entertaining programs that get huge audiences. That's nice when that happens, but that's not what we are set up to do.
He points nervously to cable TV's attempts to produce educational content on the Learning Channel, the History Channel, and Discovery, all of which eventually succumbed to marketplace pressures to produce reality garbage.
There are whole television networks on cable that were founded with the idea that they could do what PBS does. And look at the Learning Channel today, you know, Honey Boo Boo, right? And they realize if they want to make money, they have to do a different type of programming.
But even if the audio slope is not so slippery and the mission creep is not so creepy, Finn represents a strain of thought among some stations that NPR's focus on growth, sellable demographics, and revenue has squandered its most valuable asset, the stations themselves, which not only aggregate the audience and pay the piper, but day in and day out represent the very diverse voices and issues and circumstances NPR was chartered to feature.
And this idea that's out there that stations are putting their claws into NPR and holding it back from its future is completely backwards. We're their competitive advantage.
That advantage played out with the recent trial and conviction of local coal baron Don Blankenship for conspiring to break mine safety rules that led to the deaths of his mine worker employees.
John, these family members are very vocal right now. They are not happy. Is there anything that you would like to say to them?
Well, just that their coal miners didn't cause the accident. That's all.
I hope you never have to bury your kid.
Obviously, emotions are running high out here outside the courtroom.
We buried our kid because of you.
Not only did NPR not send a reporter down, they trusted us to cover it. When our reporter got this excellent tape of the family members yelling at Don Blankenship on the courthouse steps, NPR took what was going to be a low-down story in ATC and made it their top story of the hour.
Such grassroots coverage isn't routine, but also not a new development. The integration of stations in the news product has ebbed and flowed since creation. Likewise, many of these suddenly high-profile organizational conflicts and kinks are as old as Susan Stanberg's pension fund. On the other hand, there are kinks, and there's Shirky's Gordian knot. Not to get too self-referential about this, but just think about WNYC, which buys shows from NPR and sells shows to NPR stations. Plus, it buys from other suppliers than NPR, This American Life, for instance, and also makes and distributes podcasts on many platforms. Soon, it will be manufacturing industrial chemicals and driving your kids to school. It is everywhere. And it's also, according to WNYC President and CEO Laura Walker, entirely bullish about NPR.
I think this is what change looks like. When we have the opportunity together as local stations, national producers, as NPR and public radio in general to be even more important and impactful. Great national journalism, but tentacles and roots in communities around the country. So I think we are up to evolving and disrupting ourselves.
But as NPR meets its obligation to follow the audience wherever it's getting its audio, increasingly on smartphones, that has represented a threat to the stations. Is that a problem for which there is yet to be a solution?
NPR is actually really lucky because NPR gets fees from the stations. They get underwriting basically from the stations, and it gets grant money. That's a great model. And it doesn't have to be that the stations are going to hold NPR back. That, frankly, I think is a story that is a convenient story to tell. But I don't think that's where it's at. I think it's about creating the next level of what that national-local partnership means that actually strengthens the stations and strengthens the connection with their listeners because people want it. We know people want it.
What pisses you off about NPR? I mean, slow, glacial, bureaucratic, reactive, arrogant. I mean, what's on the list?
I'm sorry,
I can see you presidenting.
Yeah, you know.
I can see the the presidential rays are shooting out of you. I wish I were wearing a leaded apron.
No, I'm trying to be thoughtful about it. We all in public radio need to sound more like this country, be more like this country. And I think NPR honestly, truly is making such progress in the last several years in terms of being a journalistic and other partner to us.
I'm sorry. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do I understand you as saying that it had begun to look more and more like its stereotype of urban coastal elites and white people with tote bags?
Not really. I mean, I think that every media organization in this country needs to be looking at itself deeply every day. Every day we at WNYC, we ask ourselves, if we were inventing public radio now, what would it look like? You know, every day. And every day we want to innovate in ways that are going to be responsive to this changing media environment, to this crazy world we're living in, and stick very close to our values. And I just want to do that in partnership with the smart people at NPR and our colleagues around the country. And if anything, we like to be ahead. We're New Yorkers. We believe deeply that people want to hear what New Yorkers think. So we're out there
innovating.
Well, we
don't want any part of your values.
But I think that we have this incredible opportunity to remake public radio.
NPR itself declined to speak with us about its plan or about anything else. But Laura Walker does make some salient points. The network's multiple sources of revenue, endowments, foundation grants, advertising, and individual donors via station programming fees are indeed the envy of the media industry, which has been decimated across the board by plummeting ad revenue. And while Morning Edition and All Things Considered have lost broadcast audience in chunks, they are making up some of the losses online. Furthermore, NPR News is not only the most robust and serious national broadcast news operation, it's almost the last one standing. The networks bring you headlines for 22 minutes a day. Cable news channels talk endlessly about the news, but they seldom really report any. Bill Siemering.
I think we need to pause a moment and just celebrate the incredible talent that is public radio today. It's just breathtaking.
Yes, but so are the challenges. The increasing obsolescence of broadcast transmission is not a trivial matter. And how NPR and its member stations adapt is anyone's guess. It's likely that at some point, All Things Considered and Morning Edition will cease to be the twin suns around which the rest of the system orbits. The current podcast boom could bust when venture capital runs out and its ad revenue, like everybody else's, fails to cover the nut. As for serving the underserved, consider a station like WXPR-FM of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. It, of course, plays Morning Edition and All Things Considered, but it also offers such local oddities as The Polka Show and Dream Farm Radio. For the near future, at least, it is not going to be smartphoned and podcasted into irrelevance. Because its listeners so cherish WXPR's content? Maybe. But also, they don't have Wi-Fi.
Or high-speed internet availability here in northern Wisconsin, as in other parts of the country.
Pete Rondello is WXPR's president and general manager.
The broadcast part of our signal is still very viable. So when do we turn the transmitters off? It might be 30 or 40 years from now, Bob.
But elsewhere in the NPR universe, the converging threats have an almost mythic quality. If not a Gordian knot, then a sword of Damocles dangling ever perilously above. Just remember that to get out from under, Damocles had to rethink how big and powerful he really needed to be.
The sword of Damocles is hanging over my head. And I've got the feeling someone's gotta be cutting the thread.
Coming up, free speech runs headlong into the refugee crisis in the heart of the European Union. This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It will come as no surprise that in Turkey you can be jailed for insulting President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. What is shocking is that a critic of Erdogan has been charged with that crime in Germany. A little-used and little-noticed German law prohibits ad hominem attacks against heads of state if the foreign leader requests prosecution and if the German leader agrees. Erdogan filed his complaint last week, putting German Chancellor Angela Merkel in a tough spot, pitting free speech against Germany's urgent need for Turkey's help in the refugee crisis. When we recorded the next interview, she had not yet announced her decision, but on Friday, Merkel did announce that she has indeed authorized Erdogan's request. The whole mess all started with a poem read by a TV comedian named Jan Böhmermann. The first line describes Erdogan as dumb, cowardly, and repressed.
Sack doof, feige und verklemmt. Is Erdogan der Präsident?
But this wasn't the really rude part, actually, the one you played.
Christian Hoffmann is deputy head of the Berlin office of the German news weekly Der Spiegel.
his so-called poem is actually a very simple rhyme with extremely insulting wording involving animals, involving the size of the intimate body parts, and so on. He is trying to insult.
Like teenagers in a locker room.
Very much so. And it was actually broadcast in an internet platform and was supposed to be broadcast also in the second program of public television. Later, the German television extinguished the poem from its libraries, so it couldn't be watched there anymore.
What was the occasion for Jan Böhmermann to take off on Erdogan?
Well, there had been another television program before that that was a more substantial political criticism of Erdogan, and the Turkish president complained about this TV program. So this was actually the reason why Böhmermann took the case up. Like you would say to a little child, now I show you what you are forbidden to do. He said, now I will make a poem that is really forbidden.
You want to see insulting? I'll show you insulting.
Exactly.
Let's play a little bit of the video that originally annoyed Erdogan and started this whole cycle of ad hominem.
Redaktion wird dicht gemacht. Er denkt nicht lange nach und fährt mit Tränen, Gas und Wasserwerfern durch die Nacht. Sei schön charmant, denn er hat dich in der Hand. Erdogi, Erdobo, Erdogan.
Das ist sehr catchy.
Yeah, it's a famous German song that everyone would know, and they just rewrote the song with the name of Erdogan.
Mm-hmm. And it's criticizing his authoritarianism, his abuse of political critics.
And, you know, the way he goes against demonstrators and freedom of press. But it's not rude, you know, that's the big difference. It's not insulting. This is criticism. What Böhmermann did was insult.
All right, but the astonishing part of this story is that Germany, smack in the middle of the EU, indeed the biggest player in the EU, does not protect even insulting speech, that it's a crime. Who knew? When was this law written and how often has it been used?
Well, I don't really think anyone was aware of the law until we had this. We now learned that it has been used in the 60s when demonstrations went on against the Shah of Persia with insulting slogans. And it has been used about 10 years ago when the Swiss president felt that he had been insulted, but no one even knew about that case. So it was very surprising that this paragraph from the 19th century was found again, so to say.
I'm a bit stunned that a 19th century law, paragraph 103, could have survived the forming of the German Republic, two world wars, Nazification and denazification, a new constitution. How in the world do you suppose Erdogan found it?
I have no idea. But actually, Germany is not the only country to have a law like this. Switzerland does too. And in the late 40s, when Germany was still under administration of the four powers, this law was applied against Spiegel, actually, against my news magazine, by the British authority at that time, because obviously Spiegel insulted the Dutch queen.
Now, we are speaking on Thursday, by which time the chancellor was supposed to have had made a decision on whether to assuage Erdogan by invoking the law. At this moment, you know of no such decision. She doesn't have to like Erdogan, but she absolutely needs him. There is this grave refugee crisis that affects Germany probably disproportionately to other European countries, and he is in many ways the solution.
Exactly. I mean, that's what makes this case so big, is that it demonstrates how Germany has become dependent on Erdogan's goodwill, and especially Chancellor Merkel, because she has founded her whole way of handling the refugee crisis on Turkey and on Erdogan. She has made a, I think, strategic mistake in the beginning of this affair when she announced that she thought the poem was deliberately insulting. So she gave her verdict on the poem without even being asked. everyone could understand that she did this to pacify Erdogan, and this is what put her in a very difficult position.
You know, there's some irony in this. Erdogan came to power largely because at one point he was in the political opposition, and he himself recited a poem that landed his sorry butt in jail. It's hard for me to imagine that there would be any domestic support for her kowtowing to an authoritarian bully.
Well, it has been quite mixed, actually. There is a majority in Germany who accept that there should be limits to freedom of speech and expression. And a lot of people think that Böhmermann's poem is unnecessarily insulting. But on the other hand, there are certainly no sympathies for Erdogan. Commentators say that it would be a good thing if politics stayed out of the case and it would be left for the German courts to decide where are the limits of freedom of expression.
It's a tough one to penetrate the American psyche, where almost no speech is too much speech.
Well, I don't know. I mean, probably the most rude word that was used in the poem was goat f***er. I don't know if anyone said that to anyone in a public discussion in the U.S. If no one would care about it, is that really the case?
Well, I don't know. I do know that this is America, and if you call somebody a no-good, thieving, authoritarian goat f***er, you'd better be able to produce the goat.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
That was Thursday night. The next morning, Angela Merkel made her decision. So we called Christian back. Christian, you told us there was a chance that Merkel would let this go to the courts, which is exactly what she did.
She said in her press conference it was not for the government to decide the limits of freedom of press, freedom of expression. It was judiciary to decide about that. There had been differences of opinion inside her coalition government, but in the end, she was the one who took the decision.
Merkel did say that paragraph 103 at the heart of this controversy is not long for this world, that they're going to get rid of this article. So this, I presume, can never come up again?
I think so, yes. She announced the paragraph 103 should be abolished within this legislation period. That means the end of 2017. And I think actually that was the compromise she made with her coalition partner. They had demanded for the paragraph to be abolished. Yeah, this might actually be the last case under this law.
Let's just say the public prosecutor decides, no, there's really no case, or simply prosecutes it and the comedian is acquitted. Is this necessarily over?
Not necessarily. I mean, Erdogan's lawyer, he has a German lawyer now, and he has already announced that he will take this to the highest court possible. So Erdogan will keep on pressing, even if we don't have Article 103. And I think this is going to go on.
Christian, thank you very, very much.
Okay, yeah, very welcome.
Christian Hoffmann is deputy head of the Berlin office of the German newsweekly Der Spiegel. Coming up, another man whose character was famously called into question on TV in the United States. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This weekend, HBO airs the movie Confirmation, marking the 25th anniversary of the sensational televised confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. Nominated in 1991 by President George H.W. Bush to succeed liberal Justice Thurgood Marshall, Thomas raised eyebrows with his less-than-sterling legal pedigree, but the hearings were destined to be more formality than show trial, until the late emergence of an Oklahoma law professor named Anita Hill, who recounted episodes of sexual harassment during her two stints in Thomas's employ. Once she told that story, all hell broke loose. This is Republican Senator Arlen Specter interrogating Hill in 1991.
You are not now drawing a conclusion that Judge Thomas sexually harassed you.
Yes, I am drawing that conclusion. That
well,
is
then
my...
I don't understand.
Pardon me?
Then I don't understand.
Dahlia Lithwick, legal affairs correspondent at Slate and host of the Amicus podcast, has seen the movie. Dahlia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
First of all, did they get it right?
You know, there's going to be a lot of fighting about whether they got it right. We've already heard some pushback from several senators. Alan Simpson doesn't like his portrayal. Jack Danforth doesn't like his portrayal. I think Joe Biden doesn't much like it. I will say this was meticulously researched. A lot of the key moments that you see in the film are verbatim. They tried really hard to convey the idea that we are not going to relitigate this. We're going to show it to you and you figure out what you think.
As you say, the movie was completely agnostic on Clarence Thomas's character apart from this unbelievable testimony that was coming from her mouth. Kerry Washington, who played Professor Hill, played it extremely reserved and extremely in control in otherwise just a completely out-of-control situation.
What Kerry Washington really ably captures is that quality of just being all alone. The Democrats on the committee more or less abandoned her. The process, as I think is transparently obvious from the film, is not fair. There she is sitting by herself at a table answering insane questions for hours and hours.
You drew an inference that Judge Thomas might want you to look at pornographic films, but you told the FBI specifically that he never asked you to watch the films. Is that correct?
He never said, let's go to my apartment and watch films. He did say, you ought to see this material.
But when you testified, as I wrote it down, we ought to look at pornographic movies together. That was an expression of what was in your mind.
That was the inference that I drew, yes.
And it's so striking, you know, this whole committee is comprised at the time of white men, and they're so out of their depth on handling both these very fraught questions of race and of gender. I interviewed Professor Hill 2 years ago, and she said, I thought, the most revelatory thing. She said what she learned after this process was that Clarence Thomas had a race and she had a gender. That what the committee did was that they afforded him race. She was not a black woman. She was just a woman. And this is so masterfully handled in the film when Wendell Pierce delivers that lynching line.
And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it's a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks.
They are so overmastered by his claim that he is being lynched by her, an African-American woman, that at that moment she realizes it's over because all she has is gender. And this litany of stereotypes about how she's an erotomaniac, she's lifting material from The Exorcist, throwing herself at him. And so you get these kind of Shakespearean tropes about her as this spurned woman.
One thing that movies and television are really good at is putting beautiful people in front of cameras. What they're not great at is faithfully recreating really anything that has to do with the machinery of government and the judicial system. How did these filmmakers do?
I think they did really well. And I think what the filmmakers here said is this was never a legal process. You come away saying, this has the trappings of the quasi-judicial, quasi-investigatory body. But what it really was just blood sport. The film opens with the borking of Robert Bork, and you realize just the shimmering, incandescent rage that animates the Republicans on this committee who have been thwarted.
This is a street fight, Joe. And if a friend of mine is attacked in a street fight, I'm going to pick up a crowbar.
This, in some sense, had very little to do with Anita Hill until it had to do with Anita Hill. This had to do with absolute fury on the part of Senate Republicans that Bork did not get his seat.
I want to ask you about Professor Hill. She seemed, at least to me and other sympathetic ears, that she was a victim of just an extremely ugly and destructive political process, and that she was being made to pay a price for sins of the past. But what I think the film makes clear, and actually explicitly clear at the end, is that she's not so much a victim as a martyr for a cause that led to, at a minimum, greater awareness of a nasty reality of sexual harassment, and then also led to having more women in places of power in the Congress and elsewhere.
That's right. And I think one of the most achingly powerful scenes happens at the very end of the movie, where she goes back to her office in Oklahoma, and there's stacks and stacks of mail. All these women who haven't spoken out, who have been abused and humiliated and degraded and stayed on the job because they need a paycheck, all of them write to her. I don't even know if she'd use the word martyr. I think she'd say, look, I became a symbol. It became important for me to sit there and answer questions about why a woman would stay.
When he left his position of power or authority over you, why in God's name would you ever speak to a man like that the rest of your life?
That's a very good question. I have suggested that I was afraid of retaliation. I was afraid of damage to my professional life. And I believe that you have to understand that this response, and that's one of the things that I have come to understand about harassment, that this kind of response is not atypical.
And it was so patently clear that the senators on the Judiciary Committee, who kept saying incredulously, why didn't you report this? Why did you stay? The idea that without being touched, that could still be harassment, that was unthinkable in that moment in time. And now we all understand that a man doesn't have to hurt a woman or dock her paycheck in order to be guilty of sexual harassment. So I think by almost every measure, we can say, yes, it moved the needle. Yes, it created awareness. The national conversation now stipulates and understands that this happens. It happens too much, that there are legal remedies, and that there are things women can do. And that really, really is a profound sea change.
You know what the other silver lining is, Dahlia? The political polarization that characterized the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. 25 years later, as we look at a new nominee, Merrick Garland, for the high court, it's all just faded away, and now the Senate will collegially consider the president's nominee and give its advice and consent, move the process seamlessly along. We've come such a long way.
You know, I was so struck when I watched this movie this week that we thought that was a constitutional crisis, right? I mean, we watched that riveted 3 days of pre-Kardashian Kardashianism. And then you look at today, where I think we really are on the precipice of something that looks like a constitutional crisis. But there's no sex. There's no drama. There's nothing. There's just a 62-year-old white guy who gets up and goes to work every morning. And to me, it's so striking the way that that moment in history came alive for us because we watched it on television, because we got to be a part of it. We got to see ourselves in that. Do I believe him? Do I believe her? Now we have a nominee who is a legitimate nominee. We should be having a process that's existed for centuries in this country. And yet, because there's no story to tell, there's no drama, there's no TV, it's like it's not even happening.
Dahlia, as always, thank you very much.
As always, it's a joy to be with you.
Dahlia Lithwick, legal affairs correspondent at Slate and host of the podcast Amicus. When the actual confirmation hearings were taking place, chances are you didn't think twice about tuning in. And you probably didn't recoil at the thought of those proceedings being turned into a high-budget TV movie. But if someone were to now write a book based on the TV movie based on the real events, Would you buy it? I'm guessing not. But why? OTM producer Jesse Brenneman reports.
You know the experience. You're standing in an airport or the grocery store checkout lane, and you notice a glossy paperback titled, say, Batman vs. Superman. And you think, I didn't know that was a book first. And then you see the dreaded words, adapted from the screenplay. And you think, oh. And you keep moving. No, there's not much respect for the film novelization, and nobody knows it better than the people who write them.
But it seems to be the only thing that people recognize, so I usually say novelization and then in parentheses say dreaded term.
Max Allan Collins is author of over 30 novelizations, including Saving Private Ryan, The Mummy Trilogy, and Waterworld. Like many authors, he's worked his entire professional life to get out from under our disdain.
The nasty and sometimes deserved reputation of being subliterature.
That you have a bunch of writers who are not good enough to write books of their own. Just take a script and type it in book form for a quick check over a weekend.
That's Lee Goldberg, author of what he prefers to call media tie-ins, including two successful series of novels based on the television shows Monk and Diagnosis Murder. Goldberg and Collins were both fed up with the contempt for a trade that employs hundreds of writers and creates stacks of bestsellers. So they co-founded the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers, or IAMTW.
Or I am a tie-in writer. You know, the Mystery Writers of America, the Science Fiction Writers of America, the Romance Writers of America looked down their noses at these books. And we thought it was time that the authors toiling in this world got some respect. Also demystified what they were doing, educated other writers and the media and readers about what goes into writing a tie-in novel.
So what exactly does go into writing a tie-in novel? First of all, a lot more than just copying and pasting.
I would largely throw the dialogue in the script away because I feel that movie script dialogue and novel dialogue are completely two different things.
Max Allan Collins.
Movies have a real habit of cutting from A to C or A to D, and people are hip enough to just sort of fill that in. But in a novel, the writer is expected to tell you how they got from, you know, the forest to the city. So it's a whole different way of viewing the material.
The very first novelization I did was 12 Monkeys.
That's Elizabeth Hand, who later novelized the 1998 X-Files film and Halle Berry's Catwoman. Hand was an author in her own right, but when tackling that first adaptation, she turned to her friend and fellow novelizer, Terry Bisson.
And then I said, Terry, what do I do? How do I do this? You know, I'm looking at this screenplay and there's not a lot there. There's just a little dialogue. And he said, well, he has this great Kentucky drawl. He said, well, the first thing you got to know is that when somebody walks into a room and sits in a chair, if that's what the stage direction says, he doesn't just walk in the room and sit in the chair. He ambles slowly across the oriental rugs that are covering the polished hardwood floors. And with a sigh, he sank deeply into the beautifully upholstered velvet wing chair. And I said, okay, well, I guess I can do that.
My eyes were open to the riches of the genre when I stumbled upon the novelization of the original Star Wars film. I was an adolescent Star Wars obsessive, and the book was amazing, not because it was just like the film, but because it was so different. In addition to new scenes and history, there were changes so arbitrary that they just had to have some deeper meaning. For instance, instead of the famous "a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away," the book begins with "another time, another galaxy."
Well, it was just a film. I mean, everything hadn't been codified and brought down from Mount Sinai.
That's Alan Dean Foster, author of the original Star Wars novelization, which he ghostwrote for George Lucas. And those cryptic changes that I endowed with such significance, chances are he made most of them up. Which he could do, because in 1976, George Lucas was just the director of American Graffiti, and Star Wars was not yet a multi-billion dollar industry.
Basically, it was, here's the screenplay, here's a couple of quick shots of people involved in the film. I saw about 10 minutes of rushes one day at Industrial Light and Magic. Go write the book. And I finished the book, I turned it in, George read it, said, that's fine. And that was it.
That a Star Wars fanatic like me could read Foster's book and think it was the original source material is, for novelizers like Max Allan Collins, the dream.
I run into people all the time that think, what a genius I must have been. You know, I created CSI, and I created Saving Private Ryan, and I created Air Force One, and all this stuff, which is just absurd. But I take some credit because the book was enough of a legitimate experience to them that they didn't just feel they were getting the literary equivalent of a lunchbox.
Which raises a question. Why is our admiration so contingent upon the order of the adaptation? For authors like Alan Dean Foster, it's a source of constant frustration.
It doesn't make any sense that you can take a best-selling book that sold millions of copies all over the world, like, say, Ben-Hur, extract a screenplay from it, win an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay, and everybody says that's a great piece of writing, when that's much easier to do than take a screenplay and make a novel out of it.
And plenty of novelizers have been stuck with unenviable tasks. There's a novelization of the Britney Spears film Crossroads.
Now I know that life doesn't always go my way. It feels like I'm caught in the middle, and that's when I realize that I'm not a girl, not yet a woman.
And then there are those novelizations whose very existence is mind-bending, like this one.
Ethan Hawke, Gwyneth Paltrow, with Anne Bancroft and Robert De Niro. Great Expectations.
The cover of which reads, novelization by Deborah Cheel, based on the novel by Charles Dickens, based on the motion picture written by Mitch Glazer. But the cream of the weird crop is easily the children's novelization of The Cat in the Hat, starring Mike Myers. The original Cat in the Hat begins like this.
The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So he sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day.
The novelization begins like this.
The worst day ever. It really was. For starters, I was sitting in the family room, staring out the window. I mean, that's not the way I usually spend my Saturdays. But my Game Boy was taking a ride in my mom's purse, and the TV was tuned to C-SPAN. On a good day.
And yet sometimes less than stellar subject matter leads to the most successful novelizations. Lee Goldberg.
Elizabeth Hand wrote the novelization of the Catwoman screenplay. The Catwoman movie was a bomb with Halle Berry. The book was such a big bestseller, they talked about doing sequels to her novelization.
There was really nothing in the screenplay at all to go on with this character. So what I ended up doing, there was a character in the screenplay, a professor of catology, who tells her how she got her magic cat powers.
Elizabeth Hand.
So I ended up writing three or four little stories within the story that were drawn on different legends about cats. And I sort of held my breath to see if they would buy it.
And often, the studios don't. As Max Allen Collins learned the hard way when he found himself in the unique position of writing the novelization for the 2002 film Road to Perdition, based on his own graphic novel.
I sat down and I wrote 70, 80,000 word novel, very faithful to the movie script, but filling in things from the graphic novel. And they came back to me and said, we want nothing in here that isn't in the script. Nothing. And it was my characters. They were not allowing me to do anything with my characters. That was a very unhappy experience.
So why do they do it?
Sebastian Fox and William Boyd are literary novelists, and yet they pandered to do a James Bond novel? Why?
Lee Goldberg.
Well, it's James Bond. A lot of authors feel the same way about Star Wars or Star Trek or the X-Men or Bunk or whatever. They want to have a chance to write those characters that they love, to explore those worlds.
For Max Allen Collins, it helps to remember who his intended audience is.
I did Waterworld. I don't know if I want to know the 55-year-old guy that picked up Waterworld and read it. I'm not really sure I want to hang with that guy. But the 14-year-old who read it and wrote me a letter about it, you know what? He's going to grow up. He's going to be reading all through those years. And if he loved my book, I got a customer.
Plus, you know.
Writers always need money.
Elizabeth Hand.
Samuel Johnson said, no man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money.
Beethoven didn't sit around turning out symphonies for fun.
Alan Dean Foster.
They're all done in commission. They're all done to be paid. And Rembrandt sat around painting fat businessmen all day. And I don't think that that's probably what he wanted to paint all the time.
And as you dive further into the history of novelizations, something else starts to become clear. The relationship between films and books is not always so straightforward. The first hit novelization was 1932's King Kong, which was released as a promotion before the film. Fritz Lang's classic Metropolis was based on the novel written by his wife, Thea von Harbau, which she wrote with the movie in mind. And Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey novel came out after Stanley Kubrick's film, but Kubrick and Clarke developed the book together as a precursor to the movie. In that screenplay, there's a line that seems to speak directly to the novelizer's task.
I am putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think that any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
Or perhaps, on more cynical days, it's a line from another classic.
Look, I ain't in this for your revolution, and I'm not in it for you, princess. I expect to be well paid. I'm in it for the money.
A line which is in the novelization, albeit with a few minor changes. For On the Media, I'm Jesse Brenneman.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Dasha Luzitsina and David Conrad, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.